Okay, before we begin, an important announcement. All of the shiurim, including this one of the week of March 19th, are dedicated by Mel David to the blessed memory of his father, Avraham, David Avraham Meir ben Mordechai Zal, on his 47th yahrzeit. Bezras Hashem, our learning should serve in his merit as well. Okay, we're going to do something a little different today. We're going to take two different pieces and put them together. And that's possible for us, not only because I can do it, but also because this Shabbos, we read two different sections. We read Vayikra, we open the book of Vayikra, and we also read Parshas Chodesh. We also read the story of the beginning of the story of Yitzias Mitzrayim. So what that does for us is it provides for us an opportunity to look at Karbanot in general, and then to take a look at the Karban Pesach in particular. And we're going to see that the Karban Pesach is a turning point in the process of Karbanot across history, and it's going to serve as a paradigm for us as to how to understand Karbanot in general. So let's begin. And the first part of the session is a review of some of the points we've made over the years concerning the development of Karbanot in Jewish thought, and then we'll get to the Karban Pesach. Let's begin with a historical overview. Who was the first person in the Torah to offer a Karban? Kayin, correct. The first person to offer a Karban of some type, an offering of some type in the Torah, is Cain. Now, it's interesting in that the Medrash will tell us that Adam offered a Karban as well, but that's not in the text. In the text, Cain is the initiator of Karbanot. And from the point that Cain originates the Karbanot, or offers a Mincha, from that time onward, throughout the rest of the Torah until we get to the Karban Pesach, every single Karban that's listed in the Torah is a man-initiated event. It's not initiated by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So let's first begin with taking a look at Cain and Hevel, because that's an important piece for us, because it's the beginning of Karbanot, and it's the beginning of ritual. It's actually the first ritual that takes place within the Torah, other than the statement that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has in the seventh day of creation, that is Shabbat. But the first actual ritual performed by an individual, Cain and Hevel. So let's take a look at that section. Vayimiketz Yomim, it was after a number of days. Vayavei Cain mepri ha'adama mincha l'Hashem. Cain brought a mincha to Hashem. Vehevel hevi gam hu b'koros tzono michel vehen, vayisha Hashem el Hevel v'yel minchato. Hevel also brought from the best of his material, and God responded or turned to Hevel ve'el minchato. Ve'el Cain ve'el minchato lo sha'a. But to Cain and to his offering, God did not respond. All right, now let's stop there. We're left with a mystery. We don't know why Hashem responds to Hevel and doesn't respond to Cain, right? It could emerge from some of the texts, but there's no direct statement as to why that takes place. But there is something very interesting that does emerge in the text, and that is, look at the phraseology. Vayisha Hashem el Hevel v'el minchato. Yeah, go ahead. Well, he brings the firstlings of his flock. That is one indication as to why God may have accepted his offering and not Cain's. But what's strange about the phrase? Just the phrase, Vayisha Hashem el Hevel v'el minchato. That's correct. Correct. In other words, if you were writing the text, Kaviyochel, and you wanted to be sparing in words, which we believe the Torah is, you would have written, or I would have written, Vayisha Hashem el minchat Hevel. God responded to Hevel's offering. But that's not what the Torah says. What does the Torah say? Vayisha Hashem el Hevel vi el minchato. So what is the Torah telling us? Which is what Nikki said, correct, correct, good. Which means what? Which means that ritual in and of itself is not the significant factor, right? What is the significant factor? You, right, exactly, you. The way you bring yourself in, what you do, how you're doing it, who you are representing, what's in your heart. These are the things that, in the final analysis, will lend significance to the ritual. So Vayisha Hashem El Hevel Ve'el Minchato is at the moment of ritual's birth, is telling us that about ritual and about karbanot, that the karban itself is not the significant issue. It's the individual bringing the karban. Now let's take a look at what happens. Cain became very angered and his face fell. There are two reactions that Cain has to what's happening here. One is anger. What's the second? With your face falls, what does that mean? Disappointment or despair? Despair, depression, right? So what is his reaction? What does Cain, if you're primitive man and you're Cain, what are you feeling right now? No? You've been rejected from God by God, right? And arbitrarily from your perspective. In other words, you don't understand, why is God accepting Hevel and his mincha and not accepting my mincha, right? What's the problem? What's going on here? And what does he do? Eventually he'll kill his brother because he gets rid of the competition. Hold on a second. I have my allergies are bothering me. I have to just go get a napkin and blow my nose. Hold on 1 second.
Thank you.
Get me a couple. All right. So therefore, Cain finds this to be, thank you very much, an arbitrary rejection, and he's depressed and he's angered. And now take a look at what Hashem says to him. And when you look at what Hashem says to him, you will agree with me that this is perhaps one of the most important sentences in the Torah. Hashem says to him, Lama charalach, v'lama naflu fanecha, why are you upset and why is your face fallen? Halo imtativ se'et v'imtelo tativ napesa chatos rovets. Isn't it true that if you do well, you will be accepted? And if you don't do well, then sin crouches at the door. Ve'elecho teshukaso v'atotim shobo. And you have the power to rule over it. What in your words, what is God saying here? It's up to you. Why are you despairing? Why are you angry? Right? All you have to do is do the right thing and I will accept you. Now again, we don't know why Cain didn't do the right thing, but it wasn't right. Whatever it is that and then what does Cain do? Cain then rises up to kill his brother. Why does he kill his brother? I think so. Competition is correct. It's not if you believe that there are two people, it's okay. If you believe that there are two people in the world, and God has arbitrarily rejected you and accepted the other, what's the best way to make sure that God will accept you? Get rid of the competition. So it's not just that Cain is, not just that Cain is jealous of Hevel. It's deeper than that. It's his way of dealing. He would rather live in a world where an arbitrary God will choose arbitrarily than a world that depends upon what? His own actions. And he's running away from that. And that becomes a very, very critical lesson to us, in that what Hashem is saying to us is that it's up to us. It's up to, yes. Uh-huh, okay. Okay. Angry and it's... Right. It never leads to... Inevitably. Right. Okay. All right. But anyway, that's correct. So what you're adding to the picture is the anger piece, that and how it affects us here. But what we're very, very clearly seeing at the birth of ritual and at the birth of Karbanot is that it's not the ritual, but the person. Not the action, but the intent. Now, don't misunderstand me. The action is important, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu will tell us what he expects from us in terms of actions, and we have to follow that through. But again, it's the meaning behind it that also it needs to be there. As I said, from that point on until we get to the Karban Pesach, every Karban is a man-initiated event. God does not command Karbanot, with two potential exceptions, and they're not exceptions. One is the Brit Bein HaBtarim, which is when God says to Avram, take animals, cut them in half, and he establishes a covenant with Avraham that informs him that his children are going to go down to a strange land. He tells them about the Inu, they'll be tormented there, but they will come back, etc., etc. And God sort of, the kaviyako passes through the pieces. This is not a karban. According to some, this is the way Britot were created at that time, some suggest. But one way or the other, it's not an offering to God, but it's part of this promise that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving to Avram. The other one is the Akedah, which is the only one where you could argue that God is commanding the sacrifice, but of course the Akedah never occurs. And whose idea is it to offer the ram that does get sacrificed? All right, Hashem doesn't command it. Correct. So until you get to the Karban Pesach, when you get to the Karban Pesach, simultaneous with the birth of the Jewish nation, God initiates the concept of Karbanot. And before we get to the Karban Pesach, let's take a look at some of the ways in which Chazal wrestle with the ideas of Karbanot. And I did this in very much summary fashion. We've done this in much longer fashion before, but I wanted to just go over it. The Rambam, in his attempt to understand Karbanot, offers two very different approaches in two very different works. In his Yad HaChazakah, or his Mishneh Torah, which is the primary halachic work that he does, which is to take all of oral law up to that point and codify it, he refers to Karbanot as chukim. Chukim are what? Laws for which there is no reason. For either laws for which we, depending on who you hold like, either laws that for which we don't know the reason, or laws from our perspective that have to be reasonless. The only thing that they are there for is to say that we are loyal to HaKadosh Baruch Hu by performing them. So that's one approach. And he's speaking there to the committed, to those. In his Mishnah, in his Mora Nevuchim, the Rambam offers a very different approach, the one that's very famous and controversial. And that is what? Who knows? It's a concession to man's inability to move me hakotzeh el hakotzeh. He says you can't take man and move him from one extreme to another in sudden fashion. Bnei Yisrael are immersed in a world where karbanot are being offered. This is the way people communicate with God. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to take that and weave it into his Torah, and therefore enable Bnei Yisrael to participate in karbanot. Now this creates a firestorm. There are those like the Ramban who will say, my God, you can't, you're going to take all the karbanot and you're basically going to say it's a concession to man. And you would also expect that the Rambam would say that when society moves past karbanot, that we wouldn't do it anymore. But that's not what the Rambam says. The Rambam says that in the third Beit HaMikdash, the karbanot will return. He says once they become interwoven within Jewish thought, they are there. The Ramban, Nachmanides, who I told you is very, very strongly against the Rambam's second approach, speaks of karbanot as an educational process. He says, there, when I see that animal being sacrificed on the altar, I'm supposed to say, there but for the grace of God, all right, I'm the culpable person. I'm particularly if it's a karban that's being brought for a chet or being brought for an oversight or a sin. And here you have to be very careful, because we're not being Christological. We're not saying that the karban is actually offered instead of me. No, it's more educational. It's seeing what happens to the karban. I have to understand that on some level I'm culpable. The Baal HaChinuch, the author of the Chinuch, which is an early book of Compendium of Laws, speaks of the fact that you need actions to direct person's thoughts. You can't just have, and karbanot help that. You have the Maharal of Prague, who says that the purpose of karbanot is to convey intimations of mortality, is to make us understand. The Baal Chinuch says something else which is very beautiful. I forgot to mention it. And that is, he also says that when I see this animal being offered on the altar, I should recognize the one thing that distinguishes me from the animal. And that is my ability to reason and my ability to do things that are correct. He says, when you lose that ability to reason, then you become like the animal. And that's the distinction between the two. Turn the page. Did I skip him? Right, correct. Oh, Rav Sadia Gaon says, thank you, that it's the karbanot are an off, I'm bringing of the best of my, what I own. I'm being willing to offer. It's a demonstration of my devotion to Hashem, because I'm taking something that's precious to me and I'm offering it to God. Last week we spoke about our willingness to offer time to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Here we're talking about our willingness to offer material to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Numerous commentaries will talk about every different aspects of the karbanot and say you learn from this, and you learn from this. But then there is one overarching, and this is very important, one overarching fact about karbanot that we often forget, and it's worth remembering, because it changes the way we view karbanot. And that is that most of the karbanot ended up being shared meals with God. Except for the olah and exceptions, every karban was partially offered on the altar, but then either consumed by the Kohanim and at times consumed by the owners. And particularly when it comes to karbanot that I'm bringing because I did a sin b'shogeg, because I, through oversight, through lack of attention, I committed a sin, what I'm doing is I'm repairing my relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Lahavdil elef havdalos, I'm calling my friend who I have friction with, and I'm saying, let's sit down and have a cup of coffee. In other words, I am sharing this with God. And that becomes much, that becomes a whole different way of looking at Karbanot than assuming that they are totally sacrificed on the altar. And what's interesting is that non-Jews were able to bring Karbanot in the Beis HaMikdash as well, but they were limited to Olot. They could only offer animals entirely on the altar because they didn't have this concept of they shared meals with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's a beautiful thought. Okay, in other words, what you're saying, it's a reversal of Cain's sin, because instead of sharing, Cain tried to eliminate, right? Very nice, very nice. Okay, so these are some, there are, we could talk about this at length, but these are some of the approaches that are offered within the commentaries to the concept of Karbanot that perhaps help us relate a little bit more easily to something that is very hard for us to relate to. Did I tell you guys the story of the Korean ministers who came to the synagogue? No, I didn't. All right, so I'm going to very, very quickly tell you the story, and then we're going to get to the Karbon Pesach. I don't know if you remember this, Nikki. One day I was, during my time in Nikki was a member of my shul, and is a member of my shul in Englewood. I get a phone call. Phone call is, Rabbi, I am a Korean Christian minister that lives in Fort Lee, the next town. And I represent a group of Korean Christian ministers. And we are doing comparative religion. And we'd like to come and see your service. We'd like to come on a Sabbath to your services, about 15 of us. Now, I got scared right away, right? What would the reaction of, two reasons. What would the reaction of my congregation be to 15 Korean Christian ministers that suddenly showed up? And secondly, what would they see? They'd hear a lot of mumbo jumbo that they didn't understand. They'd see people in the corner talking about the stock market. They'd see children running up and down the aisle. They'd see me clapping for quiet. What is it that they could expect I could get from coming to a very large Orthodox synagogue without knowing what the parameters were? I'll get you. Hold on a minute. Let's see, gave away the punchline, my God. All right, so what happens? What happens is I say to them, you know what? You can come, but first you have to come on a Tuesday morning and let me give you an orientation. Let me talk to you about the synagogue. Let me show you what we have, what this is, what that is, what the Aron is, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll answer any of your questions, et cetera. So sure enough, 15 Korean ministers show up, and I say, and then we'll announce to the congregation that you're going to come, so it won't be a surprise, etc. They sit down, and I do my orientation, and then I say, are there any questions? And then there was quiet, and then the first hand went up and said, where do you do the animal sacrifices? And I said, what? And they said, where do you do the animal sacrifices? And I said, and they kept at it for 45 minutes. They kept pounding me. They could not, and why not? What was their issue? Their issue wasn't us. Their issue was their own religion. Their issue was, these were fundamentalist Christians who believed that you could not relate to God directly. There had to be something between you and God. And in the Old Testament religion, what was that? Karbanot. And what did they do? They substituted a human sacrifice, as it were, for Karbanot. So from their perspective, they could not believe in Old Testament Jews, and I'm using their terminology, that did not offer Karbanot. When I said to them, we believe we can relate directly to, they couldn't take it. They couldn't handle it. Because it destroyed the foundations of their understanding of the development of their own religion. But that's what happened. All right, you picked it up. All right. Oh, I said it last time. Did they end up coming on Shabbos? They sure did. They sure did. They came, and you know, and whenever you open up the questions to an audience like that, you've got to expect anything. I mean, I've spoken to Christian audiences before. I remember speaking to a number of to a group of Catholic school children, and the first question a girl asked me was, "What is the significance of the different colored skull caps?" The different colored skull caps. Okay? Now that is a logical question, right? I mean, and I guess there is a significance, right? When you look at the different kinds of kippot. But anyway, the point being that was an aside. Now let's go to the Korban Pesach. So take a look at the commandment, or the opening commandment concerning the Korban Pesach. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe ve'el Aharon be'eretz Mitzrayim lemor. HaChodesh hazeh lochem rosh chodeshim rishon hu lechodshei hashana. So we are at we're at a critical moment. It's right before the Exodus. And God is giving the first mitzvot, the first national mitzvot to Klal Yisrael. And he starts with Rosh Chodesh. And that's a whole nother study. Why he starts with Rosh Chodesh and the sanctification of time and etc. But then he moves on. Dabru el kol adas Yisrael lemor be'asor lachodesh hazev yikulohem ish selebeisavo selebois. Speak to the assembled, the entire assembly of Israel to say, on the 10th of the month they will take an animal, and set it aside in full view of the Egyptians. This is actually Shabbos HaGadol. And what they're supposed to do, v'imyim ad habayis miyos miseh, and if the family is too small to consume the offering, then you're supposed to create a chabura. You're supposed to go to your neighbors and join together every person. And when you determine what you're doing for this offering, you should do it on the basis of what every person can eat. In other words, you're supposed to estimate. Then later on, the text will say, "V'achlu es abasor b'alaylo azetz liotzli eish matzos almrorim yochluhu." You should eat this basar on that night, roasted, and with matzos and maror. And then finally, "V'kacha tochlu oso masnechem chagurim na'alechem b'raglechem u'makelchem b'yedchem." And this is how you should eat it, with your loins girded, with your staff in your hand, with your shoes on your feet, etc. Okay. So those are the introductory few sentences, and then two other sentences from this discussion of the Korban Pesach. What is amazing is that if you look carefully, lessons emerge from this ritual that are powerfully pertinent to the moment. Now, what is this moment? This moment is the birth of the Jewish nation, right? This is when it begins. And the first thing that we see is that Hashem says, Damru el kol adas Yisrael lemor. Now I go to step one, family meal, extended family. God turns to Klal Yisrael and says, tomorrow you're becoming a nation. He does not order them to have demonstrations in town square. He does not order them to create a constitution. That Torah will be the constitution. He does not tell them to set up committee meetings. Thank God. Otherwise, we'd still be in Egypt. Right? What does he tell them to do? He says, go home. Go home and have a family meal. Because that's really what the Korban Pesach is. The Korban Pesach of Mitzrayim takes place without an altar. We call it a Korban, but there's no altar, there's no sacrifice. Later on, there'll be aspects of sacrifice. But right now, it is in its entirety a family meal. And what's the message? It's a message that you and I have shared before. The most critical component in the survival of the Jewish nation is the family. Period, finish, start, end, period. And what Hashem is saying to Klal Yisrael on the eve of the birth of the nation is, go home, sit with your children, sit with everybody, and create that meal, and celebrate. And he also says, celebrate avot, celebrate. Also, he doesn't just say to the house, but to the house of the fathers, extended family. Have grandparents. Remember, one of the things that we've spoken about with Yaakov, what does Yaakov do? Yaakov takes grandchildren and makes them part of the Shvatim, right? So before we leave the patriarchal era, we have what? We have grandchildren woven into the process. And Yaakov is the first of the patriarchs to relate to his grandchildren. So therefore, that's step number one. Step number one is, you're creating a nation, strengthen the family. Step number two, v'im yim'ad habayis miyos miseh, v'lokahu u'shcheno hakarov el beito b'michsas nefashot. If you are too small, if the family is too small to consume this animal, then what do? You go to your neighbor who is close to your home and you create a chabura. That was very critical, by the way, to this concept of the Korban Pesach, was the creation of a chabura. And there's all sorts of discussions in the Mishnah. What if I'm in one chabura and I want to go to another chabura? In other words, I'm creating units. What's this building step? Well, first of all, what language is superfluous, it would seem, in that sentence? What is v'lakachu u'shcheino hakarov el beito? Your neighbor who is near your house. What's a neighbor? Right? So if it says my shachein, why does it have to say hakarov el beito? Why does it have to say your neighbor who is near to your home? Possibly because what it's saying is you should consider your neighbor near to your home, right? In other words, that you are, this is part of the family. And what's happening here is we're building steps. Start with family, and family needs, then you go to community. Look how this ritual, in a few short sentences, it's building the building blocks of communal organization. And then what's the third thing it says? Ish lefi achlo tachosu al haseh. In determining how much of what this animal should be and how much I should take for this korban, I have to determine it on the basis of what every person will eat. What might that be telling me? Talking? Anybody? Okay, good. You need to be aware of the needs of others, but I think there's something even deeper than that. Okay, right. You have to compute properly and make sure that there's not overage, because if there's overage, it's going to go to waste. What else? Every person has to do his part. Ish lefiach lo tachosu al haseh. Don't think that because there's family and community that you can sit back and not be involved. Every person in that chabura has to participate in the chabura. Every person. So what do I have? Three stages. Family, community, personal responsibility. Woven into this ritual that is happening at the birth of the Jewish nation. But let's go on. Later on, The Torah will say, V'achlu es habasar ba'laylo hazeh tzli eish umatzo samrorim yochlu. You should eat this animal on that night, roasted with matzah and maror. Anybody have a question here? I'm sorry, say again.
Too indigestible,
okay, all right. As it is, we have enough trouble doing it, right? Right? What? Ah, la 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 la. Where does matzah come from in our minds? Matzah comes from when they leave and they are not able to, what? They're not able to let it rise, the moment of freedom. Where? Matzah's not born yet. What's matzah doing here on the night of the Karbon Pesach?
But I thought matzah was also food of slaves.
Ah, okay. So, okay. Well, that's something else, right? But that comes later, right? But and is woven here into the Karbon. Well said. But in the Seder, you refer to matzah twice. First time you refer to it, Halachma Anyo Diachalu Avosenu B'Mitzrayim. This is the bread of affliction that we ate in Egypt. The second time you refer to it, you'll say during Rabban Gamliel's process, Matzozu al Shumma. Why? Because they couldn't wait and there wasn't time and it didn't have a chance to rise. Which means that matzah is a unique symbol. It's the only symbol at the Seder that really symbolizes both slavery and freedom. It's not just one or the other. Four cups of wine is freedom, right? The maror is slavery. Matzah's both. And how can matzah be both? All right, so I've got my own little shtick here. Let's think for a minute. What distinguishes matzah from chametz?
Time.
Time. How much time?
18 minutes.
Everybody says 18 minutes. Not right. 1 second. Correct. Meaning 1 second over 18 minutes, and it's chametz. 1 second below 18 minutes, it's matzah. What distinguishes one from the other is that split second of time. And there's a sort of a sticky way to remember this. Matzah and chametz, the words, same letters. The only difference between the two is the hey and the chet. What's the difference between a hey and a chet? A little shmichik, right? And that's the reminder that the matzah and the maror, the matzah is the symbol distinguished from its antithesis, right? Think of chametz, right? Antithesis by that split second of time. And what does this teach us? First of all, matzah can be a symbol of both slavery and freedom because it symbolizes the moment of transition from one to the other. And it reminds us of the importance of every second of time. That each moment of time can be invested with tremendous significance and can be a turning point in whatever process we're involved. So that's why matzah appears here. Matzah appears here because this is the matzah, as you said, that symbolizes the halach ma'anya. This is the matzah that comes before the freedom, and then there'll be the matzah that comes during the freedom. But now let's go on. V'kacha tochlu oso mosnechem chagurim na'alechem beraglechem umakelchem beyedchem v'achaltem osam b'chipazon Pesach hu l'Hashem. And this is how I want you to eat it, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says. I want you to eat it with your bags packed, right? I want you to have your staff in your hand. I want you to have your shoes on your feet. I want you to have your loins. Now, this, talk about indigestion, right? This is, why do I need to do this? V'achaltem osam b'chipazon. What's b'chipazon? In a hurry. I've been waiting for this minute for the last 210 years. Why? what do I need to eat this with speed? What's going on here? First fast food bill. Okay. All right. But what is being, what's the Torah teaching us? What's Hashem teaching us? So take a look at a fascinating statement made in the Medrash. Na'alechem b'raglechem u'makelchem b'yedchem, quoting the Torah, ki yotze dirachim. You're supposed to eat it like travelers. Rabbi Yossi Aglili Omer limda Torah derech eretz al yotze dirachim sheyu mezurazim. What does Rabbi Yossi Aglili say? What's the lesson being taught to me here? Travelers should be prepared. Huh? What is this, the Boy Scouts? I don't understand. Travelers should be prepared? What is Rav Yossi HaGlili saying?
It looks like the word from
Zrizut. They should be energetically prepared. They should be, right, you're right. It's more than just prepared. They should be alert. So what's he saying? What? Who are the Ovrei Drachim? Ovrei Drachim are the Jewish nation that's being born here. And what is he saying to us? You're travelers, guys. Be prepared. Be prepared today for tomorrow. Be prepared, right? Ezehu chacham haroa es hanolad, right? If you see what's aborning, see what's happening, be prepared. I don't know about you, but I'm heading into Pesach tremendously depressed when I look at happenings around us, right? What are we preparing? Are we preparing for something? Are we prepared? Are we looking at the future? Are we looking at what's going to come next? Or are we just like bulls in a china shop doing what we think is best, and I'm going to do what I think is best, and I'm going to protest against what I think is best, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to sit down with you, and I'm not going to sit down with you, and we're not going to talk, and what's going on? And this message, by the way, is a message that rang true during the entire Golus experience in a very real way. And is the American community prepared? Is it seeing what's aborning? All right. I'm going to talk to Nikki and find out what's happening in my community. But are people aware of the changes that are happening around them? And are we acting in ways that are responsible that will ensure that we'll be prepared for whatever it is going to come tomorrow? So that's the last message from the Korban Pesach. You're starting a journey. Your nation is beginning its historical journey across time. And now I want you to be prepared for what's about to come. I want you to know. There's a famous story. Don't know if it's true. About an eye doctor. I've said this before. Who is in Germany in Berlin in the 1930s. And he decides, seeing what's going on, he decides that he is going to make Aliyah. And he puts a sign on his door. He says, I'm going to Israel. All of you who are nearsighted, there's a doctor around the corner. For all of you who are farsighted, follow me. right? And whether it's true or not, it's the, and it's easy for us to say, look, it's easy for us to say. It's easy for us to say, had we been in, we would, who knows? Who knows? That, but you couldn't believe what was happening. You can't believe things like that. So who knows what we would have done had we been in that position. So what we see is that the Korban Pesach, which is the first God-commanded Korban, has woven into that very ritual a whole series of messages and lessons that are, in the case of the Korban Pesach, easy for us to pick up if we look carefully enough. All right, they're very evident. Most Korbanot will not be as open as the Korban Pesach in terms of their lessons. It'll be much harder for us to distinguish what it is, but they all have lessons. They all have things to teach us. And that's why the Korban Pesach is the perfect launching pad, right? It's the first, like I said, it's a shared meal. It's like most of the Korbanot, and it has woven within it all of these lessons that are open and clear for us to see. And that's how Hashem launches the process of Korbanot across the face of time. Okay, so we accomplished a whole lot in a fairly short time, all right? We spoke about the origin of Korbanot. We spoke about some rationales for Korbanot. And finally, we analyzed the Korban Pesach as the first God-commanded Korban. All right, open the floor for questions, comments. Yes, sir, and then I'll take you. Yes. Very pretty. Very pretty. Right. What is the word karban? We talk, you know what? Drawing close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? It's to come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay. Yes, you had your hand up.
No.
I said those were the two that we might have assumed were God-commanded Korbanot. They were not, but they were not Korbanot. In other words, I said everything that happens from Kayin and Hevel till the Korban Pesach, in terms of sacrifices that are offered, are man-initiated. Avram initiates Korbanot. Yitzchak initiates Korbanot. The only things that we might have argued are God-initiated are the Brit Bein Abtarim and the Akedah, and neither of them are really Korbanot. That's right. That's correct.
Why were they not Korbanot?
Because the Brit Bein Abtarim was a way of creating a vow. It was not, Avram was not offering the animals to HaKadosh Baruch Hu or eating them. It wasn't a Korban. And the Akedah never occurs. Right? God commands it, but it doesn't happen. Whose idea was it to offer the ram?
I heard you said that it was Avram.
That's correct. That if you go back to the Torah, you'll see that what happens is Avram lifts his eyes, he sees a ram caught in a thicket, and he says, "I'll offer it." In fact, I wrote a piece on this a couple of months ago in Torah Tidbits, where that the birth of the shofar we say is from the Akedah, but it's not. It's from that moment. It's from the moment after the Akedah, when Avraham says, "I'm going to go a step further." At that moment, Avraham, at the top of the Akedah, told not to sacrifice Yitzchak, could have said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, "God, that's it. I did what you wanted me to do. I'm the top of the mountain." But what does he do? He says, "I'm going to go a step further. I'm not going to rest on my laurels." And that's when, and if you look back at the text there, you'll see the angel speaks to Avram twice. Once after he stops the Akedah, and then again after he offers the ram. And after he offers the ram, what the angel says is much more pervasive. In other words, it's much stronger. The promises are much deeper. It's because it's Avram going the next step. Well, there are those who say that the origin, the concept, that the shofar is a reminder. One of the purposes of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is to remind us of the Akedah and of that moment after the Akedah.
Then you said, this is the last question, see where that was a rationale. So
it's not a rationale. It's just a way of dealing. Basically, what he says is you don't ask questions. Right? When you approach chukim, you basically are willing to perform them without understanding. Okay. Yes, Nikki. Okay, all right. Well, a matseva, an altar is created out of many stones. A matseva is just a pillar. And sometimes you offer offerings on the pillar. What's fascinating is although the patriarchs use matsevot, which are singular stones, later the Torah will say, don't you use matsevot. And the question emerges, why was it okay for the patriarchs and not okay for us? And Rav Hirsch has a beautiful explanation. Rav Hirsch says that the matseva in the patriarchal era was a symbol of God's existence. I took something that God created and I used it. When you get to the era of the nation, we're supposed to be partners. And therefore, it has to be a mizbeach. It can't be just a matseva. I'm supposed to take what God created and use it and make an altar. All right. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Before you go, two things. Next week there will be a shir. I think I will probably dedicate it to the Seder night and talk about how to view the Haggadah and the Seder night. As part of that, and this is just an offering, don't feel obligated. Many of you know, perhaps, that I have a Haggadah that I published. If anyone is interested, I would be happy to bring some copies if anyone wants to purchase any. So let me know. And it is a Haggadah with English commentary and translation and commentary. Yes. There may be there. I think there may be one in the bookcase. I don't know, but the idea. I guess I would bring enough if there are people. Just don't. Yes, it's going to be the same time. It's going to be the same time.
What's the name of the Haggadah?
It's called Unlocking the Haggadah.
Unlocking.
Unlocking the Haggadah. Correct. Okay. All right. All the best. Let me know if you want one. Thanks. All right.